I think one of the things that makes the educators that are up on this panel, the phenomenal educators that they are, as I have to tell you, as I was sitting listening to Rav Schechter, I was watching each and every one of them taking notes on what Rav Schechter was saying. And the greatest educators are the greatest learners, because they understand how we learn, and they understand the things we care about in our learning. So we have a series of questions to ask our panel, our illustrious panel. We're not going to have each panelist address every question, so if not everyone addresses each question, we'll get a chance to hear from everyone over the course of the program. So let's begin. Our question number one is: the analytics of our YU Torah audience have indicated tremendous popularity with the shiurim that are modeled as a 5-minute, 10-minute, 20-minute summary of a Torah concept or topic. Do you view this trend as a positive development in the community's commitment to Torah learning? What are the implications of these trends relative to our in-person Torah experiences in schools, in shuls, and in other institutions? I'd like to ask Rabbi Leibowitz to begin. I think it should be on.
First of all, thank you very much for having me here. For the record, I was invited before I accepted the position. Also, for the record, I'm not the one that invented the 10-minute format. I know Chaim Eisenstein, Shlita, called me a few years ago asking for reshus to give a 10-minute Musar shiur. I said, no, I don't own 10 minutes of time. I want 10 minutes of time. It was actually something that my Talmidim had held many years ago. They had a few extra minutes during the day. They said, we'd like a quick synopsis of a halachic topic during 10 minutes, and you know, we started doing it and kept on going. So this is a very important question, whether it's something that is a positive development or a negative development. As far as, I think overall it's proven to be a positive development. It has tremendous practical benefits. Sometimes a person just has a practical need to know about a topic. They were just having a debate at their Shabbos table just last night. Someone texted me, we were debating on the Shabbos table, is there really a school of Rishon Bayis to fold your talus after Shabbos? So I can give the one-liner that Rav Schechter says all the time, that yeah, it's a school of Rishon Bayis because it means that you're neat, and if you're neat, your wife will appreciate that. I said, you know, there's a whole topic about folding a talus on Shabbos, 10-minute halacha, they can listen for 10 minutes, they can listen on double speed so that it's actually 10 minutes, and they'll learn everything that there is to know. Or everything, the basic Russian problem about that topic. But I think there's a much more important benefit of the 10-minute format. When a person defines themselves as someone who's associated with Torah, who lives a life of Torah, it's very important to take advantage of those small amounts of time. So of course, it's not a replacement for a chavrusa, for a serious limud. But what do you do when you have just a few minutes here and there? A person who defines themselves through their Torah will take advantage of those few minutes here and there. I was just reading Rabbi Lopiansky's Sefer for people who are graduates of yeshiva and trying to adjust to work life, and he gives the mashal of a power nap. Now, there's this idea that you sleep a night's sleep, and that's very good and important, but sometimes in the middle of the day you just sleep that short power nap to re-energize you. And he said, that's what these 10-minute shiurim are, or 20-minute shiurim, or 5-minute shiurim. It's that power nap that re-energizes you spiritually when you have a few extra minutes on your lunch break. I think that's a very, very valuable element of it. And without speaking for too long, I just want to point out one more thing. I think the 10-minute format is a great mechayev for the person who's teaching in that format. Because very often, when you're giving an hour-long shiur, so you can sort of figure it out as you're going along. You're sort of like reading the sources, oh, that's what it means, and you figure it out as you're going along. It takes twice as long, three times as long, to prepare a 10-minute halacha shiur than it does to prepare an hour-long halacha shiur. You have to figure out what's important, you have to organize it exactly correctly to make sure that you have maximum impact. And I think people appreciate that. People appreciate the efficiency of it. I was telling one of my Talmidim recently, who's going into Rabbanus now, I said, I want you to listen to the hesped that George Bush gave for his father at the Levaya of, at the funeral of George Bush Sr. He said he was being masped a president of the United States. He was being asked by a person who lived a long and very full life, and he did it in 10.5 minutes. Now, sometimes people think you need hours and hours to convey a message. If you're efficient, you can convey a powerful message in a shorter amount of time. And having that in mind, I'm going to stop speaking.
Okay, so thank you, Rabbi Glasser, for putting this morning together, and to Rabbi Shor for all your hard work. What can I say about this question? There are a lot of different perspectives, but one thing I definitely will add to what already was mentioned, and that is when I was in Azrieli, and I'm sure many in the room have been through courses on education, I remember one of the most grueling tasks that they used to ask us to do was to watch TED Talks as often as we could. And at the time, I thought it was such a strange thing to ask students to do. And I really didn't understand the value until you realize how incredible it is that you can have a nuclear scientist who has years and years of experience and research behind them, and they figure out how to explain it to the layman who is completely uneducated in whatever subject matter that they are presenting. But because they're excited about it and they've figured out how to consolidate that knowledge into 10 minutes, it's something that is actually effective. And it's something that I still do all the time. I watch other people's presentations to understand how it is that you can take a topic that is so complicated and somehow narrow it down to its most basic and most important principles that people need to know about and figure out how to present that effectively in 10 minutes. It's an important job to learn how to do, but it's something that I think our world, as Rabbi Leibowitz said, very much appreciates. At the same time, I had the great privilege of speaking at Rabbi Leibowitz's celebration for his 5,000th shiur that went on YHTorah.org. And that was a very special weekend that we had in North Woodmere, celebrating that opportunity. And because the members of Rabbi Leibowitz's shul know how much I admire his shiurim and his leadership, they had asked that I join over the Shabbos to speak a little bit in his honor. And one thing that I said then, and I believe it to be true till today, obviously, is what the Medrash writes in Sefer Shemos Rabbah. So the Medrash tells us, Ha'ezov nirla adam she'eno klum. You look at a blade of grass, and who pays attention to it? And how many people just walk by a leaf on a tree or a blade of grass on the floor and just pick it up, rip it off the tree, rip it out of the ground, and nobody pays attention to that at all. Nobody thinks there's a consequence. However, writes the Medrash, Abokotho gadol lefnei ha'elokim. The power of that small blade of grass that seems so insignificant to all of us is really something that has a tremendous amount of power, and it has great significance. And the Medrash writes that in the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, that actually is what saved the Jewish people from being destroyed. They were instructed to take a blade of grass and to use that to put the blood over the doorstep, and that's really what saved the entire Jewish community. And the Medrash then ends off and writes, "Va'yidei ezov shehushafel shebeilanos gal es Yisrael." Because of that small ezov that seems so insignificant, the entire Jewish people were saved. And I dare say that "Va'yidei ezov shehushafel shebeilanos," by us paying attention to these small 5, 10, 15, 20 minute segments of time that we have in our day, and filling them up with informative and inspirational Torah that we can find online, that is really what will be Goel Es Yisrael in our times as well.
Number one.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Thank you all for being here. I'll be honest, I'm very overwhelmed sitting next to people whose voices I hear all the time. I haven't listened to all 7,000, but for sure at least 1,000 of them I've heard. And Rav Shai also. They say that when college basketball players get to the NBA, like, very overwhelmed being in the presence of the players who they watch from a distance. So I'm a little bit overwhelmed sitting with these fine panelists. And it's really a very special supposed to be here. I was thinking this morning about the words of the Mesilas Yesharim. Because while all of the topics and all of the questions that we're going to discuss this morning are so important, it's so important to think about Torah as it's studied in the world today, I think of the words of the Ramchal, where he describes that my Sefer doesn't really have many kiddushim. It's just to reinforce and to emphasize that which is already well known. And I feel like, speak for myself, I don't want to speak on behalf of others, but I feel like I don't have any earth-shattering kiddushim to add to this morning's conversation. But again, it's amazing to just be a part of an ever-growing network of people who are teaching Torah in this way and learning Torah in this way. I agree wholeheartedly with what our Leibowitz, our Shefter, have said, that the format of our world today demands, in a certain sense, this style of learning. As Shabbos is quoting that Medrash, reminded me of another Medrash, Parshas Vayechi, where the Medrash says that Klal Yisrael are compared to fish, because Chodesh Adar, we know the Mazel of Chodesh Adar, as you enter into Adar Sheni, corresponds to the fish. The nature of fish who dwell in the water is to still rise to the surface and to catch little droplets of rain as rain descends from on high. And the question is, why would a fish whose whole life is in water ascend to the surface to receive those little droplets of water? And the answer is that Klal Yisrael, like those fish, are so thirsty for just another drop of Torah, a new idea. Whether it's a 20-minute, or a 10-minute, or a 5-minute. My daughter said to me, she said, Daddy, and she, my daughter, I have a 13-year-old daughter now who's also accessing Wired Torah. She said, Daddy, why don't you do like a 10-second shiur? 10-second chizuk, you know? Like, just say like, Hashem loves you, you know?
Wait, there are 10 seconds, sponsored by it, you know?
I'll do 8 seconds, I'll do my 10 seconds, you know? Right? But the truth is, and studies say that the unfortunate reality is that in our world today, and studies indicate this in a very frightening way, that the attention span is shrinking. And the reality is, according to at least one study I read recently, the attention span of human beings as of recent is less than that of goldfish. 9 seconds versus 8 seconds, which is a remarkable and frightening study. And people are looking for those power naps. People are looking for those short moments that they can capture and learn something significant. I happen to not give shiurim in this format. I have not yet given shiurim in this format. But I can certainly understand what Leibowitz is describing, the challenge of trying to say something meaningful and impactful and clear and organized, as he's a master of, in that short period of time. And again, I think it's just that it's addressing the reality of our world today. You know, when Rav Soloveitchik spoke in 1957 at his famous Yahrzeit Joshua, and he shared the Medrash about how Kadosh Baruch Hu, in creating the world, created many worlds before this world. And he wondered, why is it that Kadosh Baruch Hu made so many worlds in order to then finally produce the world in which we live today? Kadosh Baruch Hu couldn't get it right the first time. And he explains, or Soloveitchik explained, from his own personal experience, that Hashem was teaching us the importance of being connected to the world in which you find yourself. So the Rav, from his personal vantage point, explained, I grew up in a world of learning Torah with Chaim Brisker. I grew up in a world, he says, of spending entire nights debating passages in the Rambam with Baruch Ver Leibowitz, the Rosh Hashiva of Kamenitz. And he described, you know, conversations he had with Chaim Ozer, the great Gomer Chaim Ozer Kaczynski. And then the Rav described what it was like coming to America and building the Maimonides School in Boston and walking through the hallways and stopping a first grader and saying, tell me, what are you learning? And reviewing a pasuk and a Rashi. And our Soloveitchik said, I could have been very depressed by that experience. Or I could have said, you know what, this is how people learn today. This is where the world is holding. This is the needs of the modern student. And I think it's such a, to the credit of those who give these short format shiurim to recognize the need of people who have those short car rides or have those couple of minutes during. I'll just end. I was speaking to someone over Shabbos who told me, he saw a poster for today's program, and he said, Moshe Tzvi, I used to be all about sports radio in the car. He was cold cool of sports radio. Every car ride was sports radio. And he said, now it's just one shiur after another. And he said, I don't choose the longer format. It doesn't work for me. It's too hard to start a shiur, and then for my 20-minute ride, I'm going to stop the shiur. He said, but there's so many options to learn. Again, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. Whether it's Halacha, whether it's Machshava, whether it's Tanakh, there's just so much out there, and it's really a remarkable thing. I will just say, on the flip side, that it is important that we continue to train ourselves to handle shiurim that last for more than 10 minutes. I think it's an important part of, maybe it's obvious, but it is an important thing to be mindful of, that we continue to have the mental capacity to follow a longer shiurim. And to be interested in learning the sources inside, textually, to learn it well, not just to hear the synopsis. So again, it is a little bit of a double-edged sword in that regard, but it's a tremendous resource we're blessed to have in our lives.
Thank you so much. We've received many letters and emails from all over the world from individuals who have utilized the YU Torah platform to complete large segments of Torah study goals, some even completing Tanakh or Shas online through our shiurim. How do you view the nature of the student-teacher dynamic within this framework? Is there a necessity to have a Rebbe or a teacher of Torah that is live, or can an online experience suffice? How has the role of a Torah teacher evolved in our generation of online learning? And how has this affected your own reach and relationships in your teaching experience? Now we're going to ask Znu Gushel to start us off.
So while we're talking today about an entirely new medium and something that's so exciting in terms of even the methodology within a new methodology within a new medium, I really think we're talking about a very old search. Even older than me, and for my own search, I feel the question you've asked about the relationship with a teacher, whether it's a Talmud Rebbe, Yemora, Talmud Zah relationship, talks about the search of Talmud Torah more than the grasp and the reach of the token and the content that we've spoken about so far. The search for Talmud Torah, the search for the answer, the search for the conversation is a two-way street. It isn't just about providing material, but it is about building the personality and offering an invitation to join the conversation over the ages. I remember growing up where it really was just about the svarim on a bookshelf. And if you were lucky to have svarim or a house or access to a bank address, you'd be able to take the svarim off and maybe jump into the Yama Talmud or the Yama Torah and be able to have a conversation. Beginning, frankly, before the internet, before the platform of the World Wide Web, beginning with a Hashkafic perspective that really stems from YU that says, Torah is the center of every person's world. Kihem chayenu l'arach yameinu is not limited to those who either can afford to go to Beis Medrash, or those who have the language already readily accessible to them, or those who are set up to do that, but asking everyone to learn and to consider what their own contribution to that conversation of Torah, I think began a very long time ago. And I think that's always been critical in the dialogue of discovery and the dialogue of making Torah meaningful and a part of our life. So yes, it's true. We have so much, thousands and thousands of hours, minutes, seconds, the capacity to build it into our lives. But I really think of this as almost like an enhancement kit. An enhancement kit that has the capacity to invite everyone in. Personally, I've been contributing, but also I've been the beneficiary of the entire Hashkafic worldview as well as just this new medium. But at the same time, the entire world of education has shifted the model, and it's interesting to see, I don't really think that it's so new to Talmud Torah, it's interesting to see that the model in education is telling us now that a teacher is not supposed to be the sage on the stage, excuse where we are, but the guide on the side, a facilitator, someone who invites and pushes and prompts and probes and asks you, what are you going to do now with it? Obviously, that's a long, much longer than the short bites of Torah in our daily commute. It's a much longer trek. It's a much longer journey. But that methodology is recognizing that the thirst for knowledge in an age where supposedly information is cheap, we all have it, is not a thirst just for content. It's a thirst for a dialogue and a conversation. And Torah requires that that happens also after. Certainly, we're the recipients, we're the eager, thirsty neshama who are asking to learn more. But that's not where it stops. And I believe, without sounding too regressive, it cannot stop there. Right? There is no solidity to Torah learning if it's unidirectional. It needs to be fluid in the sense that our Talmidim, my Talmidot, are invited into the conversation, taught and expected to take what we've given them and to ask what the next layer of application is, even if it's not halacha l'maisa, because that is the definition, in my opinion, of what it means to actually be a modern Jew, Medak Levinet and Tzayit, which is the Tzemach Tzedek's description of how every parsha and everything that you're learning has something to say to you. So if what I'm learning was said by somebody 1,000 miles away, I can get a little personality, I can hear the jokes, I can write down in my margins if I'm actually sitting down, the little anecdotes. I have a feeling, I have a time, but I really don't have a hadracha. And that hadracha only comes from a relationship. So I'm so grateful for the opportunity to get a flavor of the personalities of the various Rabbanim, thousands and thousands and thousands that I wouldn't otherwise have access to within our community and beyond. However, I would tell you that I think our Talmidim and our Talmidot need to have that mental Velcro, the glue that connects these ideas to their lives and their lives back to Torah.
So there is a Gemara Basafis Erev and Daf Yud Gimel, where we're told, Amar Rebbe, the famous Rebbe, Haydet Mechadavna Mechabrei, this that I am, I guess, more accomplished, this that I am sharper than all of my contemporaries and all of my friends, is the Chazite L'Rameir Me'achorei. It is because I have the opportunity to experience an in-person interaction with Rav Meir. And that is something that many other members of our generation did not have. That's what Rebbe says about his contemporaries and about his friends. And it's a very telling statement, because he lived at a time where there were many, many great personalities. And in the times of the Mishnayos and the Gemara, there were always some towering figures, and I'm sure when he walked down the street, he bumped into many of them. And he attributed his success solely to the opportunity that he had to see and experience what it meant to be in the presence of greatness. What did it mean to be in the sphere that hosted Rav Meir? And not only did he have the experience Me'achorei, but that was something that was able to make a profound impression on him forever. So I think what that Gemara teaches us is that we need to make sure that we develop those kinds of relationships. I was telling Rabbi Hibwit just before we started, it was snowing yesterday, and on my way to shul, I was walking to shul with my son in the morning. And I feel bad that my father's not here to hear this, but I hope somebody will tell him later. But I was walking to shul, and my son turned to me, he's 8 years old, and he said, you know, it's very hard to walk in the snow. So I acknowledged, I said, yes, it is hard. So he says, you know what, let me just walk in your footsteps. And I said, that is something that I feel is the greatest thing I can say this morning. And unfortunately, my father's not here. But we live in a world that has a lot of difficult snow to walk through. And the way we as Talmidim look at my father and all of his contemporaries is we say, the only way that we have the opportunity not only to teach Torah, but to be able to do whatever it is that we do and to be able to live through the world that we are now interacting with. And it seems to be becoming more and more difficult and more complex, but we walk in the footsteps of our fathers and of our teachers. And that's an incredible gift that you can only have if you develop a relationship, if you develop that rapport with teachers in person, that you can actually have the feeling of what it is that my teachers would want me to do. How would my teachers want me to walk in this kind of circumstance? How would they want me to react, and what would they want me to say if I was confronted with this reality? So one final comment on this point, and there's so much to say, I hope to hear from the other panelists, but the Gemara Maseches Makos tells us as well, if there should be a situation where somebody is a rotzeach b'shogeg, he's not at fault, he kills somebody accidentally, and now the Torah says he has to go to Arei Mikla. So the Gemara says a surprising statement, madlin rabo imo. We make not only the student go to the Arei Mikla and stay there, but also we make his teacher go along with him, which seems to be almost unfair. Why do we make the teacher go along? He was not a rotzeach b'shogeg, he didn't seem to do anything wrong, and yet he has to go along regardless. And the Rambam expands on that, and he says, Hichaye, because the life of a person who is Balei HaChachma Ulevachshel, a person who lives life really having an interest in spiritual endeavors, below Talmud, if you strip them away of that opportunity to have the Rebbe-Talmud relationship that we all need to have, Kimisa Hashuvim. That is comparable to death, says the Rambam. And after all, the Torah says, when somebody goes to Arei Miklat, b'chei achicha imach, you have to make sure that you give them a surrounding, an environment, you create a place where they can actually live. Arei Miklat is not to kill people. Arei Miklat is to give them a place of refuge. And therefore, the Rambam says, if you would strip the person of the opportunity to have the encounter with their teacher when they are in Arei Miklat, that would be kenisa chashuvim. Again, a very telling statement of the Rambam and the Gemara, but it shows how critically important it is that we all develop these relationships with our teachers and with those who are so much a force of the lives that we live.
I'm very glad this question was asked. This is one I feel very passionate about, and I certainly agree with everything that's been said up until this point. The Mesorah is something that is so critical to us as Jews. You know, I remember, I've said the story a lot lately, but it's something that so sticks out in my mind so much from my time in yeshiva. I remember when we were living with Sefer Sukkah and Sefer Shir. So we started in the beginning of the year, Daf Beis. We got to about Daf Mem by the end of the year. Shef likes to keep it moving. So it must have been around this time of the year. We were on Daf Chav Ches. And there's some Agadah to on Daf Chav Ches in Sefer Sukkah. And the Gemara describes the Talmidim of Hillel Azaki. And the Gemara tells us that the Gadol Shem Kula was Yonasan Ben Uziel. What was so great about Yonasan Ben Uziel? That when he was learning Torah, if a bird would fly overhead, the bird, Miyad Nisraf, would be consumed by a fire. And Rashi explains, it'd be consumed by a fire because the Malachim would come to listen to his Torah. They would want to hear what Yonasan Ben Uziel was saying. So the bird would run into the Malachim and immediately become consumed by the Malachim. So remember, Rosh Hashanah getting very emotional. He started to cry a little bit and he said, "You boys, you have no idea what it means to have Malachim want to come and hear what the Rebbe is saying." He said, every day in our Soloveitchik Shir, we felt like the Torah that our Soloveitchik was giving us was so beautiful that the Malachim were coming to listen to Shir together with us each and every day. And I remember looking around at the people around me. Who was it? Of Tani Cohn, of Danny Stein, of Ephraim Goldberg, of Tani Schwartz, and many others. And thinking, we think we know what it feels like. We understand what it feels like to have the Malachim come to Shir. And that's such an important part of learning Torah, to have that experience with the Rebbe. But I want to make three quick points about how that plays out on Wadi Torah, how that plays out on Torah over the internet. First point is that we are in yeshiva for a certain amount of time, but most people at a certain point leave the yeshiva, go out into the world, and continue with their lives, and at that point it's very hard to maintain a kesher with the Rebbe. It's much more difficult. You don't see the Rebbe every day. For the first 15 years that I was teaching, I didn't have such close access to my Rebbe, to Rosh Hashanah, to my Rebbe Willick. I didn't have such close access. Every once in a while, before Rosh Hashanah, I moved to the Five Towns. So Rosh Hashanah would come to the Five Towns a couple times a year, and I would go and hear him say Shir. I'd try to get the opportunity to drive him back and forth, but it wasn't that consistent. And having the ability to continue to learn on a daily basis from him kept a relationship that existed, even if not on his side, but at least on my side. I was still the Talmud guy. I still get to learn from my Rebbe. Point number two is that there are a lot of people that don't have a Rebbe. And this is something that we've discovered, I'm sure everyone sitting on this panel can attest to this. That people have reached out to us. I grew up in a different kind of community. I never heard a shir the way you give it. I never heard that kind of hashkafa. I've never heard that kind of attitude. Do you mind if I call you with questions? Do you mind? And they start developing a relationship. People who don't have a Rebbe find a Rebbe because of the accessibility of it. And the third point that I found, at least, is that most people, I don't know if it's most, I don't know who hasn't reached out, but many people eventually do reach out. Meaning people feel that they do need a connection with the Rebbe, and even if they're only learning through the website, eventually they'll reach out. They'll email, they'll call, they'll try to connect in some way or another. I can't tell you how many times I go to my shul in the morning to say the Daf Yomi Shir, and there's someone there from Boston, from Boston, from Ontario, from wherever. Which I live by JFK, so it helps. So they stop in because they're participants in the Shir every single day. So now they want to participate in person. And they want to build that relationship. I've been invited, the question mentioned that people have completed Tanakh or Shas. I've been invited to multiple Siyumei HaShas that people have made, people I've never met. And I remember driving one Sunday to Muncie, because what an opportunity that is, to participate in Siyumei HaShas someone you never met. So it's not that this is a replacement for Rebbe. I don't think people view it that way. I think people would feel empty if that was the case. It's a great way to continue a relationship with the Rebbe and to begin a relationship with the new man.
Thank you. Given the popularity of online Torah education, should we be finding more ways to integrate technology into the Torah education of our schools? And what are some of the innovative ideas that educational institutions can implement which build upon these innovative developments?
So I'll start by saying that I think schools and probably other institutions in our community also, but schools primarily, have to be both cultural and countercultural. You have to, like I said, you know, the terminology of the Samach Tzedek, you have to use the language of the generation. You have to be prepared to meet somebody b'asher u'sham, where they're at. But you also have to move them. And if you're just staying where they are, then there's really no purpose. It's a holding cell for the next stage where they're really going to grow. So cultural would mean that we have to integrate technology, and I think that that's being done in many ways, not just on the skills level, but also helping our students see the depth and the complexity of Torah sources, raising the standard of expectation because they have the opportunity to do as much research as perhaps their teacher might have previously done just by themselves, but now the student coming to you has a chance to really know the topic. If you set the standard there, right? However, that is only using a tool that now becomes suffused in their experience in the world, and I think that that's tremendously valuable. So that everyone learning Torah doesn't think that they're stepping back into the ancient Torah, but they understand that this is a Torah that is a Torah Chaim that has the same tools and the same access and the same depth. And even more complexity than they maybe would have been able to get in a 40-minute, an hour, 15-minute class that they could have gotten beforehand. We certainly, culturally, again, using the language and the tools of the day, need to be giving them all the portals that they can, whether it's the Bar-Ilan research sources. But at the same time, there is a countercultural feature that I think is really critical, in especially in Torah education, which is, in a generation where information is cheap, where there's an expectation of quick, easy, fast access, even democratic, I can, I should, I know, Rav Google will answer me, there needs to be a difference between ease and easy. We're not looking to train our students to assume that Torah knowledge and Torah access and Torah scholarship and Torah and Amelut Torah that they need to have is going to be easy. There needs to be the opportunity to sweat it through. There needs to be the real connection to the difficulty of Torah. Even if it's present and even if it's available, it isn't easy. And so in schools, in addition to raising a standard of content knowledge, making sure that our students know that the modern technologies have made Torah available to them with a greater and higher level of standards. They now can have language. Yes, they can look on Wikipedia. But if you read beyond just the first entry, the footnote will take you someplace amazing if you really look for it and if you're really expected to do it. And in addition to that, the second countercultural feature that I think is really important, not just about the ease versus the easiness, but also is this expectation that our students don't replace the Svarim and the Tzuras Hadaf with printouts or with screens. And schools need to be the laboratory for that too. We're not just looking to push forward, but we also need to anchor our students in the same feeling and the same textuality and the same understanding that one word on a page in Radak or Abarbanel produces hundreds of words through multiple generations and across different continents. that you lose because technology is flat. When you just pull it up on a screen, not only is our different parts of our brains being animated and energized, it's not the depth, it's the shallows. We also have to realize that different parts of our souls are being animated and energized. And there's real, so what we've done is just changed the list of things that a teacher needs to do and that a student needs to be able to do. We increase, but we don't diminish. We add an expansion pack of tools and portals and access and language and tochein and a sense of knowledge, but we don't diminish because you still need to be able to open up a Shulchan Aruch and understand, open up a Mishnah Berurah and understand that the Mishnah Berurah doesn't stand on its own. Right? That there is a conversation there between the generations, and if you're going to be a part of that conversation, you have to be able to navigate all the spaces that is present on the traditional Daf Makaros.
The truth is, I wasn't slated to speak about this question, but I happen to have pretty strong feelings about it. I think we've lost ourselves somehow educationally in terms of schools, and talking specifically elementary and high schools, with our obsession with technology. And I agree wholeheartedly, but the experience of sitting with a sefer, opening up a book, it's not just because there was a time when people didn't have access to these technologies. There's something very real and very special about it. And this desire to always present the Torah with greater bells and whistles or screens or all sorts of animation, while in many ways that is responding to the need of the generation, which was addressed, it's something that that can really water down and lose a certain authentic quality of what Torah is supposed to be. I'll just share one story on this topic that always comes to mind when I think about sort of the reconciliation of the Torah of old and the Torah of the new. First of all, one of the reasons that we're all blessed to learn Torah in America and the world today is there's a great Jew by the name of Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelovich. Rav Shraga Feivel was a pioneer in Torah in America. And when Rav Shraga Feivel was trying to bring Torah to America, there were many who said, you're unrealistic in your expectations and your hopes of what the Torah learning experience can be in America. And they often said to Rashad Feivel, you know, Rashad Feivel, you're old school. You're not a 20th century thinker. And Rashad Feivel always used to respond to that. He said, you're right, I'm not a 20th century thinker. I'm a 21st century thinker. Because Rashad Feivel believed that Torah is something that goes beyond all limitations of cultural norms, of societies. He believed that if you transmit authentic Torah in an authentic way, it will always sell. So the story that comes to mind that I just want to share very quickly is the story of the different kinds of sons. The sons of Rebbe, early 19th century, great Chassidus Rebbe, was once approached on an Arab Shabbos by a woman who was holding a bucket of apples. And she came to the Rebbe with tears in her eyes and said, Rebbe, you know, I was in the marketplace, I bought this bucket of apples, I was trying to sell it to make a little bit of a profit, to buy a little something extra for Shabbos, and the apples are no good, I can't sell the apples. So Reb Chaim Sanzer, Reb Chaim Halberstam, takes the bucket of apples, he goes back to the marketplace, turns over a crate, stands up on this crate, and starts selling the apples. He says, who wants delicious, sweet, juicy apples? And people see Reb Chaim Sanzer selling apples, and say, that's a segula for something, I imagine. So in no time, the apples are all gone. They're completely gone. And he hands the sizable profit to this woman who's so thankful, and he says to her, and this is the line that's so powerful, he says to her, he says, the apples are good. The apples you're selling are good. You just have to know how to sell. You can understand that as saying, you know, the world has changed, so maybe we can't sell the Torah of old with just a plain Gemara. Maybe we need a Gemara that can, you know, pop up and do all sorts of interesting things. That's not how I learned the story. That's not how I felt about that story. I think knowing how to sell it is to believe that the Torah itself is good. That the Schora that we have to transmit, what we're selling, it's not so much about being a salesman. It's not so much about the packaging, although, again, a tremendous amount of time and energy and thoughtfulness goes into packaging Torah in a way that can be well received by the generation and learning the language of the generation. But to really believe, that the Torah that we're transmitting, not only selling, but transmitting, is very good. And sometimes, again, we play into this, like this new Rishon said, we play into a certain cultural norm where it has to be flashy and it has to be this. And again, many of the technological advances in education, there are many who are starting to realize, you know what, we're moving a little too fast. we've crippled our students by not giving them the ability to sit with a book and to be able to just engage the text and to realize, well, it might not be easy when you can learn how to actually do it and access it in an authentic way. It's the most exciting experience in the world. So again, to me, that's the danger of technology. I think, again, that every learning experience for some kids is with a screen. It's enough that they get their entertainment on a screen. We should find a way to transmit Torah in a way that it was always done. And again, Levi Omerly, I could be so bold as to use such a phrase from Rashi. My heart tells me that if we could, again, if we could transmit Torah and we're excited about it, and we give it over with passion, and we give it over with clarity, we don't need the sound effects, we don't need the pop-ups, we don't need all of the, so to speak, the simple trimmings that sometimes appear to make Torah the exciting and vibrant world that it is.
Let me just add to what was just said about this question. I think it's a very important question on many levels, but just two points that I just want to add to this topic. And that is number one, and this is in honor of the Portnoys. Before I was in the Young Israel Lumir, I had the privilege of being in the White Shul. And one of the great opportunities of being there was to sit next to Rabbi Rafael Pelkowitz every Shabbos. And it was an amazing opportunity, an unbelievable experience. And one of the things is the upside is this week, actually. Thank you for reminding me. Rabbi Pelkowitz was a giant of a man, but one of the most profound comments he made to me while I was there was explaining Gemara Maseches Menachos, where the Gemara says, "Kol ha-kelim she'asa Moshe Rabbeinu." All of the kelim that Moshe Rabbeinu constructed, sheirim lo u'ksheirim ledoros. So if Moshe Rabbeinu made a menorah or a shulchan or a mizbeach or an aram, everything was able to be used by subsequent generations. And if we today would somehow discover whatever it is that Moshe Rabbeinu had made, we would be able to actually use those kelim in our Beis HaMikdash. However, there's one exception. And the Gemara says, without explaining why, the Gemara says the one exception is Chatzotzros. Chatzotzros she'asa Moshe Rabbeinu, the trumpets that Moshe Rabbeinu made were k'sherim lo u'psulim ledoros. If subsequent generations would find or somehow discover those Chatzotzros, we would not be able to use those in our time. So the question is why? What is the difference between the Chatzotzros and all the other kelim? And Rabbi Pelkowitz shared his feeling, and that is that we believe Zos HaTorah Lo Tehem Ochlefes. The same avoda that was done by Moshe Rabbeinu is the avoda that we do today. And the same shulchan and the kelim that he used are the kelim and the shulchan that we use today. But the Chatzotzros were made as a mode of communication. Chatzotzros were the way of Moshe Rabbeinu communicating his message to the people. And that, he suggested, is something that must change in every generation based on the needs of that particular generation. We cannot use the mode of communication that may have worked to teach us or to teach our parents or grandparents for our students and our children today. It's just not going to work. And what we need to find venues and opportunities for ourselves as educators to do is to make sure that we figure out what is the mode of communication of today. How do our students and our children learn today? And what are we able to do to figure out how to get ourselves into that mode that they will listen to, into that Chatzotzros which is appropriate for today's generation? That's point number one about online learning and how sometimes it's a critical component for our education today, because that certainly is the Chatzotzros of today's generation that should not overshadow the concerns, should not take away from our ability to open a safer and to learn on our own, but it is something certainly to consider in the realm of education. And secondly, this week's parsha we learned about Moshe Rabbeinu finishing his construction of the Mishkan. And there Moshe Rabbeinu, by Yivarach Hosam, he offers a tefillah. Rashi tells us, what was that tefillah? Yirason shetishra hashina b'maseh yadecha. That God should rest his presence in your handiwork, which is simply understood to mean that after all of the time and the energy that we've invested in creating this Mishkan, I hope that God will finally come and reside in Shina here, in this beautiful edifice, in this Mishkan. Now, the Ksav Sofer points out, didn't God promise us from the outset, Ba'asuli Mikdash, V'shachanti V'sokam? So why did Moshe Rabbeinu need to offer this tefillah when God promised from the outset that he would be residing his Shina in the Mishkan? And the Ksav Sofer writes that this was not a tefillah directed to the Ribono Shel. We knew that God would reside his Shina in the Mishkan after it was completed. This was a plea to the Jewish people, and that was, after you spent so much time focusing your attention around the Mishkan and getting all of your energies to build this beautiful edifice that we now have. Yihi ratzon may be your will. Each and every member of the Jewish community, Shetishra Shina Vamasi Adechem, that now that you go back to work and you're no longer focused around this Mishkan and Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron and the Shivim Zekeinu, but now you're going to be living in your own homes, can you find a comfortable place for God to be even there? Can God be comfortable even in your office and even in your home? That is what Moshe Rabbeinu asked of the Jewish people. That is what he begged. That now that we're completing this job, can God come home with you? And that's sometimes what I feel. There's so much distraction on the internet, and there are so many dangers, and there are so many things. For those of us who interact with high school kids today, we know what they're looking at, and we know how much time they're spending on the internet on things that are certainly not of the caliber that they should be. And sometimes I get the feeling, that Y.E. Torah gives us the opportunity and the vehicle to show them that yes, in the Masiyah Dehem, in all that you do all day long, you can take some time to find a place where God can be comfortable, even there. Where you can bring God and invite Him into your experience that you're having, and whatever technology it might be, it's critical that our students and our children understand that this is something that all of technology can offer them and avail them the opportunity to take advantage of in our society as well.
I know I'm not supposed to answer this question, I just want to jump in. I'll skip next to it.
You have 10 minutes.
I just want to touch on the second half of the question. The second half of the question was, for those who don't realize we got these questions in advance, what are some of the innovative ideas that educational institutions can implement which build upon these developments? I think that's a very important part of it. So I agree wholeheartedly that the student's teacher should not become an iPad. The student's teacher should still be a teacher, and we have to be careful about that. And I remember the ongoing debate in my 18 years teaching in DRS High School, the ongoing debate of how to incorporate technology in the classroom, where we went from one extreme to the other. You know, there should be no technology in the building, to the entire class should work through the smartphone, which was a total disaster. That didn't work. But it was something we were struggling with, trying to figure out. But a couple of things that I did find that work, in case there are any teachers that listen to this. Teachers have this incredible capacity to give something to students that they really want and that they already recognize that they want, and that is good grades. And it doesn't cost the teacher anything. It's totally free. I realize, money, I don't have enough, but points, I have all the points in the world. I can keep giving you points. And using technology as a way for students to earn extra credit, I found to be very powerful tool. For example, over winter vacation, so students are going to be away for 2 weeks from the classroom, and very often away from Torah for 2 weeks. But if you can say, you know, if you come back with write-ups of your notes on 10-minute halacha shiurim, I'll give you 2 extra credit points on a test for each one that you do. And students come back who listen to 60 10-minute halacha shiurim. I don't care. So he averages 75 on his test, so he got 95. That's fine. You learned a ton. You learned so much. Or one winter vacation, we had the students. We suggested learn an Amud of Gemara a day over winter vacation. I don't remember the obscene number of points I promised them for that. And we started with Sefas Megillah, an Amud of Gemara a day. In time for Purim, we had a big Siyum with DRS. We had 30 students finishing Sefas Megillah, 11th graders, finishing Sefas Megillah right before Purim. And then they came to me and they said, we want to keep doing this. We want to move on to another Sefas, let's do Titus. And I didn't even offer them points for that. It's a very, very powerful thing. And the other place that could be very powerful, I remember when I was in 10th grade in MTA, there was an outstanding young Rebbe, and it was his first year teaching, Rebbe Yisrael Kamenetsky, he's the only reason that I've been employed for the last 18 years, and certainly the only reason I'm in Chido. And Rebbe Kamenetsky gave murderously hard tests. They were impossible. At least that's the way I remember them. I wasn't the best student in the whole world, but that's the way I remember them. And as my kids have gone through the Kamenetsky shift, the tests didn't get any easier. They're still really, really hard. But all of a sudden, he noticed that his students started doing better on them. So what there's now Elias Lodoros, what happened was he figured out how to harness technology for review for a plea. He now knows how to do a screencast where the Talmidim go home at night, and for days before the test, they're looking at the Daf Gemara that he's looking at as he's marking it up and reading it to them and explaining the Rishonim and drawing charts. And they're just following, because as an educator, just because he was born and brought up in the time before the internet, he didn't stay in that time. And he realized that there are tools that you can use to teach students that in the classroom, no, in the classroom he's doing what he always did. And the energy and the excitement and the relationship, and that all works. But at home, I remember going home trying to study for a test, I don't know where to begin. I'll look at my notes. How do I know if I'm missing something from my notes? I don't even know if I'm studying the right things. But to harness technology for that is extraordinarily useful for a teacher to use.
Thank you. How has online access to Torah content changed the way people solicit halachic guidance? Is it appropriate to Google search answers to halachic questions? How has the democratization of knowledge changed the way we relate to the myriad of opinions that are out there regarding any specific question? Or, more specifically, this past Shabbos, when I told the Balabas that something was usser, and they told me that Rabbi Leibowitz said it was mutter. Passaic Five Towns, whatever. Rabbi Leibowitz almost done.
I think that online content makes for a more educated consumer generally. Meaning someone can Google it, find some article online, at least know what the Russian problem are before asking a shayla. And generally speaking, a more educated shomel helps, a more educated questioner helps for a more educated conversation. And it's a greater mechayev for the rabbi to make sure he knows what he's talking about, and that he doesn't just answer off the cuff, which is a big yetzer hara for rabbis sometimes, even if we don't know the answer, we don't want to appear as if... I always taught my children, they're very young, I would say... who's the smartest person you know? The biggest talmud chacham you've ever met. So they go up my house, they maybe say, "Rav Shach." Then I would say, "You know who says hi?"
All these asses the same question.
I said, "You know who says I don't know more often than anybody I know?" Rav Shach. Who often says, "I don't know"? So it means different things in different contexts. That's true. But it was such a powerful lesson, because there's no doubt, you're talking to a person who's a gadol adamer, and sometimes, you know, I need to think about it, is an okay answer. Just because there are blue checks that appears in someone's WhatsApp, it doesn't mean that the answer has to come immediately. And when you know that the questioner is educated, it's a great mechayev to make sure that you're answering appropriately. At the same time, things happen sometimes too quickly online. The great Uggs controversy of last week, there was like so much misinformation and everyone was just going crazy. And that made a more educated consumer actually less educated. If you don't know what I'm talking about, it's better for you to be it's all fine. But I think that's very important. Now, as someone who prepares shiur every now and then, the internet is a very valuable tool, not only Wadi Torah, which I don't want to end this without acknowledging the great power of Wadi Torah and my unending hakaras hatov to the Katz family and to the Portnoy family, not only for giving me such a great talmud like Ron Portnoy, but my unending hakaras hatov to the family for sponsoring Wadi Torah, you know, in my first sefer. I wrote thank yous to all of my rebbeim and to all of my employers who helped me be Marcus Torah. And I wrote that the great Achsan Yishol Torah al Shem Marcus Adina Katz is responsible for 95% of the Torah that I've been privileged to teach over the years. So it's very useful on that level, but it's also just sometimes just to know where to look, just to know what the starting point is. You don't have to start from scratch, and you can see if you're missing anything. Someone's after you've filled in, you've already prepared the entire shiur. You can look things up and see what else was written and what else was said, and you can fill in the blanks very often. So it's extremely valuable when used correctly. A person should not, obviously, use the internet to pass on a halacha. That's absurd. You need to ask a shayla. A lot of times people aren't sensitive to the nuances of halacha. They don't understand. Well, the case that I have seems like the case that the fellow who I don't know who he is talking about in this article online. That must be true because it's on the internet. It seems like, but it's not really exactly the same, and a lot of times people don't appreciate that. So of course you need to speak to someone who's competent to pass it on.
I'm going to jump in here, even though I referenced this in a previous comment. I want to be more explicit now, in the sense that online content has actually not just created some kind of ethereal-based measure for everyone to have access, but has helped change the paradigm for young women to be learning in a way that they've never had an opportunity to do so before. To learn the Lashon, to really become an educated Talmidah, both in Shir and also to learn the limits, to learn how much they have the opportunity to know before they engage in asking the Rav a Shaila, and understanding that just because they haven't had opportunity to sit for hours and to pour over and to sweat and to go back and forth with a Shaul Meshav already, they have the opportunity to sit for hours and to sweat and to learn in preparation for that moment where they want to ask a Shaila. One of the things that I think hasn't become sufficiently clear is that there's actually a very important distinction between a pathway of Talmud Torah and Psak Halacha. The access that we've been granted, both in a paradigm shift in education within the Jewish community for young women and through the use of online content, has really invited us to learn deeply and to hear that that we're as educated as we possibly can be. I don't think that that is the same thing as saying, and now go get a psak online, go find the answer that fits you. Learning how to ask a shayla and learning that there is a line in content that doesn't get crossed, whether you're a ben Torah or a bat Torah, there's a line that has to then move towards the personal relationship with not only your local rabbi, but someone who is a posek halacha. That's also one that I think we need to be careful to help differentiate. There's a pathway of learning, there's a pathway of psak halacha, and then there's a pathway of a personal relationship with a rab, whether it's about ice cream, Uggs, or something much more complicated, none of which should be a direct line from a person's life to the content that they have available to them online.
I guess I'll just add that I'm not a posek, I don't pass the shadows, and I'm very well aware of that, and I think that's an important thing. You know, I think, I guess a word of caution to those who post Shiur online, and it goes to the point that you were just discussing, to be able to distinguish between a halachic-based Shiur, where you're talking about a question that has real-world consequences, and being able to actually say, I'm telling you what the halacha is in this particular case, is a distinction that has to be made. It goes back to the point that Rabbi Lebowitz made about the nuance of the process. And also an understanding through the access of all the information today, that a person, again, goes back to what we discussed earlier, has to have a Rebbe with regard to Psak Halacha. You know, the ability to shop around today is much more accessible. The ability for a person to say, well, you know, my Rebbe passed in this way, but I choose to disagree because of a particular shiur that I heard or an article that I read. Again, it loses some of the nuance. It questions the expertise of that Rebbe and the study that he has done by his Rebbe. And that's something to be very cautious about. I think as a platform, it's amazing that we give the opportunity for so many people to voice their opinion on Yadik Torah. But I think there also has to be some degree of moderation in terms of who's given permission to share halachic shiur, to make sure that they do so in a way that that highlights the importance of speaking to a rav and to a posik. And I think it also touches on a point that not everything that's being studied has to necessarily be shared in a public forum. Most of the shiurim that I have on the Lagim Torah are shiurim machshava, chasidus. I give halacha shiurim, I give gemara shiurim, but I don't post them online because I don't feel that that's my place. I think there are far superior gemara shiurim and halacha shiurim, and that's not because I have a disregard or disinterest in teaching halacha, or teaching gemara, or teaching Tanakh for that matter. But I think it's important that a person understands, again, a word to the educators, I suppose, if any educators who are listening or will be listening, to understand one's place in teaching halacha, in conveying halacha, and making sure, again, that if one is exploring a halachic sugya, that it's done so with a sensitivity that, you know, while introducing you to the facts of this topic, I may not be the final say of authority, and it's important that the teachers are cautious about it.
So just one final point on this question before we move on. So Rabbi Leibowitz and I have a great privilege to go in the summer months to the OU on Fridays. And we spend time listening to the questions that the OU Rabbanim field to my father throughout the course of the week, and they present them on Fridays. And we have a small group of Rabbanim who go together just to get shimush and to listen and to experience what it means to go through a shiur. It's a privilege just to be there, but it's also a humbling privilege because when you go through the process and you are exposed to how a halakhic question is actually broken down and how many components and perspectives need to be taken into account before the answer is given, it's not just that the nuance is missing, that obviously is going to be missing, even if you find something that seems to be a comparable halakhic shaila online. Obviously, the nuance is missing, as was mentioned. But aside from the nuance that is missing, there are so many perspectives to the question that you haven't even thought of that are extremely relevant. And not always do you understand how to break down a question and know how to answer it without knowing all of the issues that might potentially come up. So just for example, as we walked in this morning, there is a question that somebody had asked me to discuss with my father. And it's a question from someone in Israel who has a relative who is marrying a non-Jew on Shabbos and wants to know exactly how to handle that. What is supposed to be done? The wedding's going to be on Shabbos and it's going to be in America. It just so happens to be the relative lives in Israel, and the relative in Israel lives on a religious kibbutz, is a religious woman. She had a gerus through the Rabbanut. It was a 100% gerus, and she's living as a completely religious woman. How does one handle such a question? Now, it happens to be that this person does not want to pose the question to their Rav HaYishuv in Israel because he will have no idea how to even deal with such a question. Intermarriage to them, it's not even intermarriage. Marrying a sibling marrying a non-Jew is something that's so foreign, but to a rabbi in America, it's something that unfortunately we deal with far more frequently than those who are living in Israel. A question like that, and how many potential issues one can be confronted with when going to such a wedding, which, by the way, is on an island off of South Carolina, just by the way. So you're dealing with first of all, getting there, which no cars are allowed onto this island. You have to take a boat to get there. And what do you do about the issues of wheeling the baby carriage on Shabbos because there's no air, obviously? And can we consider the water around this island to be a machitza? Can that be an air? Could it not be an air? And what about the kosher food that we're going to bring? But are we allowed to sit together with all the other non-Jews who are eating non-kosher food? And what about the fact that we're not going to be down in the minyan? And what about the fact that if we just disregard this whole wedding, we're going to break apart the family? So these are just some of the complexities that have to go into answering such a question. But every question that is presented has so many factors that sometimes one who is not experienced enough in answering these kinds of questions doesn't even think about. So aside from the nuance issue, I think there's also an issue of a lack of recognition of how many issues were overlooked when a particular question was being spoken about or considered.
I want to thank our amazing panel for their insightful, incredible ideas. There will be a 10-minute summary posted on YU Torah by this afternoon for everyone who wasn't here. Really, each and every one of you shared such a nuanced perspective, drawn from your experience and expertise, and we really have tremendous hakaras hatov to you. I want to thank everyone from Yeshiva University who helped in putting today's event together, the events department, the Department of Institutional Advancement, and everyone from CJF who worked so hard. We want to thank the Katz family once again. We want to welcome all of you to the campus of YU. And for the one day a week that you cannot listen to YU Torah, and now as we heard, the unbelievable power of the Jewish book, we want to invite you all to participate in the YU Sforum Sale that is going on across the street at this very moment. Please enjoy. Thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.